Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And just a quick heads up before we get going, there is no weekly show next week. I am taking a week off to bounce the baby around while he's still a baby, but I will be publishing a Soapbox edition featuring HD Moore talking about Rumble instead of next week's weekly show, so do not miss that one. It's actually a really, really good interview. This week's show is brought to you by CMD Security. They make what can best be described as a security agent for Linux. It can handle everything from user action restriction to sort of IDR type functionality. And CMD's co-founder, Jake King, will be along in this week's sponsor slot to talk about what he's seeing out there in Linux land. Jake says there's a big cloud modernization push happening right now as people re-architect their legacy cloud infrastructure into more modern setups. CMD has been a fly on the wall for a few of those types of projects. So yeah, he's going to join us a little bit later on to talk through what they look like. That is our interview, our sponsor interview this week with Jake King, which is coming up after the week's news segment with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, Joe Biden, President Grandpa in the United States, has certainly been yelling at a cloud over the last few days.
Yes, yeah, he's being reported to have said that it is more likely that the US will end up in a real shooting war with a major power over cyber things rather than, you know, more traditional sorts of stuff like, I don't know, South China Sea, which, yeah, the rhetoric has been cranking pretty hard about the cybers lately, and we've, you know, seen it mixed up in all sorts of international relations. And, I mean, on the one hand, I mean, yes, you can totally see that, you know, taking out another state's critical infrastructure, you know, with the cybers could potentially warrant a kinetic response and lead to a war. On the other hand, we've seen so much kind of talking, and yeah, we kind of need to see some actual outcomes and results. And I don't know that, you know, saber rattling is exactly what we need here.
He's really rattling the old cyber saber, isn't he? And yes. I just wonder if all of this tough guy rhetoric is coming from the fact that the Democratic Party in the United States is still very deeply upset over what happened in 2016. And I think those feelings are going to make it very difficult for them to get anything done with Russia, because they are still mad.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I don't know that Russia takes particularly well to being saber-rattled at. I mean, there's, you know, look at the history of that relationship between those two superpowers going back through the Cold War. And there's just, like, you know, it really does take a middle ground approach to make progress, like we did with, you know, nuclear arms limitation and that kind of thing. And, you know, rattling sabers just hasn't really worked well. And I don't, you know, I'm sure we're in a different time now, but the fundamentals of that relationship, you know, are still what they were, you know?
Oh, I think you just made a bunch of experts on that cringe.
Yeah, probably.
Possibly did, but I think we're both on the same page when it comes to this really, really, really not being helpful. When we're talking about trying to get stuff done on ransomware, for example.
Yes, exactly. When we have, you know, kind of more immediate tactical problems to solve, having this go strategic is not necessarily, you know, useful for us immediately. Like, we're still going to have ransomware-filled shows to talk about for a long time, I guess.
Look, we should point out, too, that he wasn't saying explicitly that it would be a shooting war with Russia, but in the same, you know, in the same breath, he basically said, look at what Russia's doing already about the 2022 elections and misinformation. It's a pure violation of our sovereignty. Is it, Joe? Is it really? But anyway, moving on, and we do have an article here, and I really am sorry to the audience in advance for talking about an article that has come to us via The Sun. The British shit rag published by Murdoch. But The Sun is reporting that senior figures in the UK government are talking about retaliating with a, you know, cyber strike after there was an attack on a oil tanker off Oman that killed a British national.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously the situation in the Gulf has been complicated for a while with Iran, and, you know, the sort of set of options that are available to the international community to deal with Iran are, you know, not great. And there's been a lot of, you know, falling back to the cybers, one gets the impression. But yeah, this, I don't know whether, you know, what are they going to do as a proportionate response to killing a British citizen, British national, you know, in the cyber realm? Like, what does that look like?
And will it be a deterrent? It just feels like, more so than in the past, you know, we used to hear these sorts of things coming out of various policy mouths in governments, but now we've got national leaders and stuff talking about this stuff, and it just feels a bit like they're playing catch up a little.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so much kind of discussion by metaphor here, you know, because they are, you know, quite a way away from the technical reality of what this looks like, you know, what doing a cyber operation would do and how you go about it and what that costs and all those kinds of things. You know, there's a lot of just kind of, I think, you know, making decisions based on metaphors that are, you know, several degrees of kind of removal from the reality of this stuff. And I'm sure it's in the briefing paper somewhere, but, yeah, you know, these options are not necessarily
magic.
You know, they're not magic, right? And they're not directly comparable to the sort of military jargon that is used to describe them, you know?
Just switching back to the US for a moment, and Biden has issued a you know, critical infrastructure security memo, and there's like minimum standards being set, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this has been a pretty sustained push out of the White House since Biden came to power. And, you know, look, as you know, I'm pretty skeptical that we can uplift our way out of the problems we're in at the moment.
Yeah, and especially at the kind of scale that the US has in terms of amount of infrastructure, and also the kind of, you know, the organizational aspect, you know, of having so much private sector, having kind of state-based regulations and federal regulations, and, you know, this kind of executive order-driven stuff, and, you know, it's a real mishmash of tools they've got to solve these problems, and it's going to take a long time. And yeah, I mean, the getting it, you know, uplifting it enough that you can't just, you know, get into organizations, get in and do what you need, you know, that's a long road, right? And obviously we need to do it, but it's, yeah, fast enough, you know, in a way that's effective enough, I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I mean, let's just say they should do it, but it's probably not going to work. But it doesn't mean it shouldn't be done. I think that's where we've landed on this, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
It's an unassailably defensible position, ours, which is, yes, they should absolutely do this good thing that won't work. But you can't argue that they shouldn't be doing uplift and they shouldn't be mandating minimum standards. Yes, but at the same time, you can still be a bit skeptical that it's going to get anywhere.
Yeah, and the kind of structural aspects of making this all work, and we haven't even talked about, you know, supply chain and all of the other kind of complicated ways that people get compromised now. Yeah, it's a hell of a road, you know.
The United States, UK and Australia actually issued a joint advisory about the most commonly exploited vulnerabilities that they've saw in 2020 and 2021, and it makes for fairly depressing reading, mostly because, you know, this isn't leet exploitation. It's the dumb stuff. Of course it was going to be the dumb stuff, but it is pretty still depressing to see it there in black and white.
Yeah, I mean, the list has all the sorts of things that, you know, people who listen to the show regularly would be familiar with, you know, Pulse Secure VPN, Citrix External Gateways, Microsoft Exchange, you know, some bugs in, you know, web apps like Telerik and Drupal, the SharePoint ones.
Excellion made it onto the 2021 list, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, good job there. Yes, I was only a few customers compromised, but enough yes, to get them on the list. Yes, you know, good work.
All of them. If you mean all of them, yes, all of them did get compromised. But yeah, so look, that's a good one to flick through if anyone wants to find that list in this week's show notes. We've just linked through to Catalan's piece about it on the Record. Now, look, speaking of the sort of info that's released by governments that's useful, we have seen a push over the last couple of years of governments, you know, releasing things like North Korean malware samples and little breadcrumbs that help people unpack like Russian APT activity, for example. And in one of those cases, I think the US via the FBI, through the FBI, released some info that then companies like RiskIQ was one, which took some of this info and sort of unpacked it and found a bunch of C2 infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, all of it got reported on. But this story from Tim Starks in CyberScoop points out that they're still using the same infrastructure. And I've got to admit to being a little bit surprised that they didn't burn it all down.
Yeah, because I mean, we've certainly had plenty of conversations about, you know, the cost to intelligence agencies of having their tools and infrastructure burnt, and, you know, how we've now kind of set that expectation, set a bit of a norm that, you know, we will burn people's capability down. And yet here we are, you know, APT29 Cozy Bear, just cruising along using a bunch of the same tooling, same malware, same C2 channels and stuff. And so maybe there wasn't so much cost in having your stuff burnt down if you're not. You know, maybe that's Five Eyes bias, thinking that we have to have good OPSEC and stuff. And the Russians,
let's just pretend that didn't happen.
Yeah, easy.
Now, I was just saying that we were going to talk about some different advice. NSA and CISA have published a Kubernetes hardening guide, and the walkthrough, as published here on the Record again, is yeah, I mean, it's pretty much the advice you'd expect to see, but it's nice having it come from like official sources.
Yeah, I mean, certainly a lot of people are deploying a lot of Kubernetes in their clouds, and you know, there is a lot, you know, complicated system like that, there is a lot to get right. So yeah, having some guidance to point to from trusted sources is really helpful when you're giving advice about these sorts of things. And it's not, you know, as you say, it's nothing that you wouldn't expect, you know, a bit of network segmentation, you know, only running stuff with minimum privilege, patching stuff, you know, having good logging, be able to attribute actions in the environment, all things you'd expect. But yeah, it's just really helpful to have, you know, quality advice that you can point to and say, hey, it's not just, you know, hacker man pen tester telling you that you should do these things. It's,
you know, you sound like you're speaking from a place of emotional hurt.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we can expect to see more of this sort of stuff coming out of NSA. We had Rob Joyce on a little while back. He's the director of the NSA Cybersecurity Directorate, and he did flag that this was the sort of stuff they'd be interested in doing. And, you know, I think it's really good, actually, to have this sort of stuff take place.
Yeah, it's certainly helpful, and you know, there's so much tech out there being built that everybody who contributes guides on how to secure stuff is really helpful, because you know, we're building it faster than we can secure it, so need all the help we can get.
Now, Tom Brewster at Forbes has written a fairly interesting story here that has an absolutely horrible headline. The headline is, "Meet Paragon, an American-funded super secretive Israeli startup that hacks WhatsApp and Signal." And of course, it doesn't really hack WhatsApp and Signal. It hacks handsets so that WhatsApp and Signal messages can be retrieved. And I know that for our audience, like, they know that, but I'm guessing the average Forbes reader wouldn't necessarily know that. So I'm a little bit, you know, miffed at the headline. But there's a lot of good stuff in here. And I think the main thing that I got from this story is that investors in the United States are going to have to really think about tipping money, startup money, into businesses like this. And this business is extremely well connected with, you know, the Israeli military and sort of at political levels as well. It's just an interesting write-up.
Yeah, it is. And I guess a lot of the kind of Israeli offensive tech companies are getting a bit more scrutiny now after, you know, NSO groups have been having a bad week. And there's probably, you know, I imagine there's a bunch of this kind of thing, you know, happening in that scene in Israel. But yeah, when you look at the pedigree of this company in terms of, you know, the bosses and all the leadership are straight out of 8200, you know, ex-Prime Minister of Israel's on the board, and, you know, American VC money showing up and or private equity money showing up and funding it all. Yeah, it's an interesting situation, especially when they are talking about only selling to democratic governments and to law enforcement, all that kind of thing. And, you know, we see, you know, people asking, well, if this is used in the US by US law enforcement, you know, how does that kind of fit into the picture of things, you know, when the Americans are funding it themselves? But you know, anything that improves the kind of scrutiny on this industry is probably useful, but you know,
I think we're at the point, I think we reached the point where governments need to actually take some action on this. I think we reached that point quite some time ago, and now we're at the point where it might actually happen.
Yeah, and I think certainly the pressure is ratcheting up a little bit. I mean, this particular company, Paragon, says they don't have any customers yet. So, you know, I don't know what this is going to do for their prospects and their return on the investors' money here. But yeah, we're definitely seeing the pressure ratchet up on this market.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this stuff has been dragged out into the open, right? And that's maybe a positive thing because, governments might say, no, you can't sell this stuff to murderous dictators. That's not cool. So let's hope that happens. Now, look, there were some reports that, and Catalan wrote the headline here, Israeli government raids NSO group offices. It looks like those early reports were a little bit wrong in that NSO said, no, it was a, you know, prearranged meeting and we had some representatives of the government turn up for a cup of tea, basically. So yeah, not so sure that it can be correctly categorized as a raid.
The raid did seem a bit, you know, hyperbolic. You know, the idea of Israeli police knocking the doors down, no, doesn't really seem like that. That's what happened. But, you know, I guess we'll see some more details as that investigation proceeds. But, yeah, the headlines certainly made for entertaining linking around.
Yeah, they did. And I think Catalan got that. He was misled, I think, a little by an Israeli newspaper that reported it. So, yeah, it didn't start with him, let's put it that way. What else have we got here? Oh, and apparently NPR is reporting that NSO Group has temporarily blocked several government clients from using its product as it investigates their possible misuse of the technology. So, you know, whether or not we actually hear anything about the result of those investigations, I mean, that's anyone's guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, and maybe we'll see something, maybe we won't. I mean, yeah, who really knows? Although, I mean, the fact that this is being, you know, leaked out from an employee or the, you know, there's people talking off the record, maybe we will.
Yeah. Now, look, we're always talking about WhatsApp and Signal, not often talking about Line. But Line is, of course, a very popular messaging app in Asia. And 100 Taiwanese politicians managed to get their Line accounts owned. This is hardly a man bites dog story.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I can't imagine who would be interested in compromising Taiwanese politicians' messaging. Like,
I'm going to say the French. It was the French,
that,
wasn't it?
That makes sense, yes. Yeah. Stop people stealing the baguette secrets. But no, so Line is, I think, based in Japan and kind of has marketed itself as a thing that is kind of outside of Chinese control, because I've always been concerned about, you know, Chinese-backed messaging systems. But yes, turns out there's more than one way to get access. You don't just have to build the tech. You can also just, you know, help yourself.
Now, you remember, it was either last year or the year before, there was this whole situation where this software that you'd have to install if you were a company operating in China, there was some software that you would have to install somewhere on your network to do some sort of admin function, right? And it turned out it was loaded with, like, you know, government malware, basically. Looks like there's another application that you have to run. It's like a employee benefits app that HR or whatever has to run if you've got a presence in some parts of China. And it's a great way to get malware, apparently.
Yeah, according to reporting, there is a bunch of kind of malware-like capability in, I think it's actually a certificate installer. So it's a piece of software published by one of the Beijing Certificate Authority, which is a state-owned company that, you know, is a CA there. And so you have to install the CA certificate. And this, I think, is the installer for their certificates for you to then be able to access this web-based, you know, kind of employee state benefit platform. And yeah, the installer for that loaded with malware. And I know we've talked, was it a few weeks ago now, maybe a month or two ago, about the certificate installer in, was it Myanmar, like Burma or Mongolia, or one of those where the national CA installer was backdoored by somebody else. This may be a case of it being backdoored not by somebody else.
Maybe. I mean, this is the thing. You got to think.
But we don't know, right?
Yeah. Is this the Chinese government trying to get visibility into corporations? Or is it GCHQ trying to get visibility through a supply chain attack on Chinese companies?
Mm-hmm. I know, right? I mean, wheels within wheels, my friend. Who knows?
We just don't know.
Maybe it's fourth party collect off the Chinese owning themselves by GCHQ, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the moral of the story, I guess, is it could have been the Dutch. I think the moral of the story is just be very careful when running mandated software in China.
Got an air gap.
Now, we got some research out of Cyber Reason that says that a bunch of Southeast Asian telecommunications companies were owned by three different Chinese APT groups all at once, which is kind of funny. I haven't been through this research myself. I'm not sure. You know, you've just got to, every time you talk about something like this that deals with attribution, you've got to be so careful because people do make mistakes. But I would not be surprised if this is accurate.
Yeah, well, yeah, certainly telcos are a real natural target, and there's been so much kind of history of them getting compromised that, you know, that aspect is certainly not a surprise. The fact that there's, you know, three different actors inside a telco, I mean, that seems low to me. I'd expect more. Maybe they're only reporting on the Chinese ones. But yeah, it's just funny when you see, you know, in this case, you know, even the same workstations having three different actors on it in the telco.
Like, that was the part that I found funny. It's like, yeah, they're fighting over memory at that point, right?
I know. It's like when, you know, you get one of those, you know, corporate desktops and it's got, you know, 400 apps in the Windows system tray and the thing runs like a dog. It's the same thing, except, you know, with APT in telcos. So anyway, there's a bunch of telcos in Southeast Asia. I imagine, you know, other telcos in the region, maybe go have a look at some of those ISOs and see what you find, because I mean, if you own five telcos, why wouldn't you own six or a dozen or 100?
Yeah. Now, we got some more information pertaining to the so-called SolarWinds hack. The Department of Justice in the United States has issued a list of a whole bunch of, like, judicial targets of the SolarWinds crew, which is kind of interesting.
Yes, so this was a case, it seems, of them using SolarWinds to get into an organization, then moving laterally up into the Office 365, you know, Microsoft 365 cloud environment, and stealing tokens or keys or creds or whatever for access to email. And in this case, yeah, a bunch of local Department of Justice, you know, kind of districts in the US. And in some cases, I think we said in New York, 80% of employees working for US attorney's offices in New York compromised by them. So
yeah,
that's so pretty clear targeting.
This is like federal DOJ district employees all over the place, 27 different offices. So it's almost like they were wondering if they're going to be indicted.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe there's a little self-interest there, you know, try and get ahead of it, see whether you should go to your, you know, for your holiday outside of Russian borders now, or maybe, you know, maybe you can do it next year.
Yeah, maybe postpone that trip to Disneyland once you see your name there in the 0365 inbox of a DOJ employee. Let's take a look at last week's newsletter. So as regular listeners would know, the Risky Biz newsletter is back. It's being written by Tom Uren, who's doing a terrific job. And he wrote a piece last week that I just think is really, really good, right? So it looks at this thing that happened in the United States to a priest. A priest was outed as a Grindr user by a small Catholic affairs publication called The Pillar. Someone provided them with mobile app data that could sort of prove this usage. The priest resigned, basically. But the really spooky thing in all of this is how easy it was for them to cross-reference his known pattern of life against a large mobile data set, find his device, and then from there expand out and find out what other apps and whatnot he was using. And what Tom's done here is it's really interesting, actually, is he's really done a good job of tying this sort of privacy risk to national security, right? So we all remember that Grindr, well, some of us wouldn't remember actually, but Grindr was actually bought by a Chinese company for a time, and then it was forcibly sort of sold back to non-Chinese interests over national security concerns. But this event shows us that who owns Grindr doesn't really matter if their privacy policy allows advertisers to scoot off with all of this juicy information, right? So it's just a really good write-up of, I guess, how ownership doesn't tell the whole story, and maybe the United States needs to get serious about privacy regulation on national security grounds.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it is a really, really interesting angle. And because we've seen such kind of an uptick in, you know, national security, supply chain, you know, company ownership being a thing, you know, obviously, you know, Huawei and all the Chinese telco providers, you know, being a thing that we are focusing on.
And TikTok more recently, relevantly.
The TikTok example, a bunch of other, you know, of companies like that where the ownership is in question. But yeah, this is just, it's really interesting to tie that across to advertising data. And you know, and maybe it's cheaper to buy the advertising data than it is to buy the company, you know? I mean, Grindr's ad mobile usage data being bought from an aggregator, probably way cheaper than buying Grindr, you know, and more effective because it gives you other options than just the one app. So yeah, it's a really good kind of way to link it together. And I mean, the US is certainly a bit behind, you know, Europe, for example, in coming up with comprehensive privacy legislation rather than state by state. And yeah, pivoting that to be about national security might actually be a really good angle, you know, for those people advocating in the US, you know, for improved privacy controls.
Yeah, so I'm going to link through to that in the show notes, obviously, so people can check that out there and, you know, subscribe for some juicy stuff every week in your inboxes. Moving on to ransomware news and the Lazio region in Italy. There's been a ransomware attack there which has forced that area to suspend booking vaccine appointments, which is not great.
Yeah, I mean, that's really horrible. And, you know, it's not a, you know, it's one region, so it's not the, you know, the hugest ransomware attack we've seen even in healthcare during this pandemic. But any attack on, you know, something as important as that is just really horrible to see reported.
I mean, this one, it's hard to feel as emotional about it, I got to be honest, but a VC firm in the Valley, they're called Advanced Technology Ventures. They got double ransomware. Someone, you know, took off with some sensitive data and locked a bunch of stuff. No word on whether they paid, but they've been talking about, you know, the data loss.
Yeah, I mean, in this case, a bunch of the information are the people who are funding, who are the investors behind the venture capital firm. You know, some of those people obviously don't necessarily want to have their identities disclosed. So I imagine the, you know, incentives for them to pay are perhaps above average. So we'll see whether they do or whether anything leaks out. But, you know, certainly a good target for ransomware operators. You know, we've seen the, you know, ransomware crews saying, hey, we're not going to go after healthcare and critical infrastructure, but we are going to go after money. you know, if you're a VC firm, you definitely want to be watching your back at this point.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Now, it looks like DarkSide has kind of disappeared and is re-emerging. Some people are saying Black Matter, which is this new crew, is kind of a re-emergence of DarkSide. The Record and Dmitry Smiljanets, I'm not sure on the pronunciation there, but he actually managed to do an interview for The Record with the Black Matter crew, and it's just crazy. It's like reading an interview with a normal, like, software development company. It's just nuts.
It really is, and it's a great interview to read, you know, because of that juxtaposition of, like, this is an organized crime gang, and this interview reads like regular PR, you know, and they're talking up their product, and they're talking about how they compare to their competitors. There's even one bit where Dmitry asks them about, you know, the speed of their encryption, and the Black Matter guy that's doing the interview, it's like, well, we downloaded one of our competitors, and we did some performance testing, and here's the benchmarks comparing us against our competitors, and, you know, in terms of number of megs a second, or files per second, or whatever it is.
They're a hair away from, you know, dumping infographics on Twitter, right? You know?
I know, right? Exactly. We can see the Gartner, you know, magic. What's the word? We can't say that word on the air,
mystical quadrangle. I think someone in Threat Intel or AV needs to do a mystical quadrangle for leaders and visionaries in the ransomware space.
Yes, exactly. And then, yeah, they talk about, you know, their plans and how they're going to scale their business and how they vet their, you know, affiliates and all that. And it just, you know, it's interesting. And then the last question is, Dmitry says, tell me a secret. And the Black Matter person says, there are no secrets, but we believe in our motherland, we love our families, and we earn money for our children.
Fat stacks of money, am I right?
Yeah, Lambos for all of the kids this year. Yeah,
that's right. Ah, so nice. Now, look, this one's been unfolding over the last, like, I want to say month or two, and we haven't really covered it because there's not really much to it, to be honest. But EA, the games company, they got owned, and attackers made off with a whole bunch of source code and whatnot, and have been threatening to release it. And EA is just like, well, there's no gamer data in there, so go for it. And they have. So that data has now been leaked.
Yeah, they dumped a bunch of source code for a bunch of EA games. Certainly, if you're the sort of researcher that's looking for, you know, copy protection circumvention or finding bugs in server-side game components, there's probably some interesting things to go have a look at there. But yeah, pretty niche in terms of data that gets dumped out of ransomware operators, you know, compared to some of it. I did think it was interesting, though, that the initial entry point into EA was the crew who did it bought Slack cookies from a dark web marketplace and then popped up in Slack, leveraged that access to move onwards and steal files and stuff. And that's a really interesting vector, because how many people, you know, have corporate Slack or any other service like that? And the idea that you can just go buy auth tokens.
Well, I mean, it's just a twist on the traditional initial access broking, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. But just interesting to see it coming in, you know, through Slack, you know, and we've seen similar things with, you know, Microsoft 365 and stuff. So yeah, just you know, interesting angle.
I remember one of my favorite comments about our show was years ago. I think someone actually managed to get into Slack's engineering channel and goatseed them, and we spoke about it. And then they popped up in a forum saying, I goatseed Slack's engineering channel and all I got was a shout out on risky.biz. You remember that? That was a while ago
I do. I should make t-shirts.
That was funny. What do we got here? Yeah, so there's been a ruling in the United States from the FTC with regard to right to repair that looks pretty positive for people who want to be able to, like, repair their own John Deere tractors and whatnot. So we got a write-up here from Cyberscoop from Tonya Riley looking at the security. Security implications of this, which aren't really that big.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important sort of conversation in terms of the, you know, the trade-off between the security of closed platforms versus the security of platforms that can be audited and inspected, and kind of, you know, where the various solutions that we use, you know, kind of fit on that spectrum. You know, things like voting machines, we kind of want to be open so that everyone can inspect them. Whereas, you know, on the other end, you know, the kind of Apple closed ecosystem for security also has reasons to argue for it. And certainly the idea that you can't fix your tractor when you're a farmer, I can see is particularly infuriating. But I mean, that's the true for a lot of vehicles these days, not just, you know, tractors.
Yeah, I think Katie Masouris is quoted in this story saying that, you know, there's some pretty big problems with this stuff around the DMCA and CFAA. So, you know, it's great that the FTC has done this for people who have right to repair and whatever, but researchers are going to get dinged for bypassing copyright controls. Like, it's kind of moot.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's part of kind of a larger readjustment of how we do that sort of, you know, introspection and visibility and indeed how that, you know, meshes up with like hosted as a service, you know, cloud places where we can't introspect how the environments work and what the controls are and or, you know, fix them ourselves. So, yeah, interesting. There's a lot of problems to solve in that world, but it is good to see some movement, you know, towards the ability to do repair.
Now, we got a story here from Dan Gooden at Ars Technica. It's a write-up of some research that's like, yeah, it's how to defeat a TPM, and it's like doing it the dumb, easy way, and you just think, oh, man, this is actually a little bit too easy. Walk us through it.
Yeah, so this is some researchers who are looking at in a laptop that had pretty much all the modern Microsoft best practices for securing hardware against, you know, someone who's stolen a laptop. So boot time BitLocker with keys in the TPM, you know, preventions for DMA attacks via the buses, you know, that sort of thing. They went through the process of recovering the key material for the disk crypto from the spy bus between the TPM chip and the rest of the machine. They actually used the pins on the like CMOS chip because they were more accessible than the TPM, but you know, shared bus, so they were able to just kind of pull it off there. And then, you know, the tooling already exists to take spy bus traces and you know, kind of recover key material and onwards to decrypting the disk. And then, of course, they're able to use that to bypass the crypto, modify stuff on disk, boot it up, steal VPN keys for the organization, and onwards to, you know, domain admin and great victory, which is kind of the problem that a TPM is meant to solve. So, you know.
Yeah, you had one job, etc. Yeah, you know, I mean, it makes you think that really the best solution here is for the TPM to be actually built into the CPU.
Yes, and we are seeing that kind of approach, you know, in some more modern platforms. But I mean, the, you know, PC architecture, it does move slowly in this respect, and the kind of commodity nature of manufacturers assembling motherboards out of a bunch of off-the-shelf parts, you know, you do end up with this kind of thing because you haven't got the kind of holistic view of the security properties that you get with, you know, full custom silicon like Apple do, for example.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, trade-off of the, you know, more generic, more repairable, more open platform.
Catalan at the Record has a write-up on a bunch of IoT bugs that affect medical equipment that is apparently present in something like 80% of hospitals in North America. And I started reading this just thinking, oh yeah, here we go. It's a bit of hype. I mean, even the headline saying the vulnerabilities impact 80% of major hospitals in North America, I thought, oh, you know, that's a bit intense, you know, to say that something's impacted, someone's impacted merely because there's a vulnerable device present in their environment. Then I actually read about this actual CVEs and I'm like, oh man.
Yeah, so this is these are bugs in like the pneumatic tube system that they use for physically moving stuff around in hospitals, where you put a little capsule and stick in a tube, and then air pressure kind of jets it around the place, and there's a bunch of little, you know, pneumatic gates and doors or whatever that make the physical capsule full of samples or whatever else you need arrive at the other side. So it's like, you know, quite a complicated system and clearly one that's real important in a hospital environment. This particular vendor is called Swisslog Healthcare. They make the Translogic Pneumatic Tube System. But yeah, the bugs, when you go look at the CVEs, it's like hard-coded passwords for the telnets.
Yeah, I mean, like, there's several things wrong with that collection of words. You know, where do I begin?
Yeah, and then, you know, Privesque and, you know, buffer overflows and, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the sort of thing you'd expect from a platform that probably hasn't really had security as a design goal back in the old days, because who would hack a pneumatic tube? Like, why would you care about it? It actually turns out...
Well, no one really would, and this is my thing, like, this is my whole point, is no one really would unless you could just throw a default credit over Telnet, and then why not?
And then, you know, well, people would hack it by accident at that point. Yeah. Botnets would hack it automatically. I mean, you know, if you're a hospital security person already, I apologize. I'm sorry you're having a bad day. But yeah, if you have one of these, might be worth making sure that it's not on the general network. And I mean, I don't know. I guess you're probably already, yeah, you may as well just kind of have a cup of coffee and a cry at this point.
I don't know
if there's any point actually patching.
PyPI has removed some malicious libraries that were trying to steal Discord tokens and credit card numbers, which is an odd shopping list.
Kids these days, bless.
Yeah, and they've also fixed some vulns that were actually affecting the repository itself. Is that right?
Yeah, so, I mean, bad packages is one thing, but remote code exec in the actual underlying infrastructure of PyPI, which was reported by, I think, a Japanese researcher, oi, 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 that's not great, because... That's a hell of a supply chain.
Well, it is, and that's why it's kind of sad that this guy got paid $1,000 for each of his bugs. And you think, geez, man, you know, those bugs are worth a lot more than $1,000 to an evil person.
They really are. And the fact that, you know, something as important as PyPI and many of the other, you know, kind of big open source package repos and stuff that are, you know, used consistently, you know, constantly around the world by automated build processes, the fact that that's, you know, a couple of people's spare time project, you know.
Yeah, it's enough to make you suck the air in between your teeth and go, I don't know, man.
Yeah. A lot of teeth sucking in this business.
Now, the last thing we're going to talk about this week is Apple kind of welching on a bounty.
Yeah, so this is a write-up from a bug hunter who had been looking into bypassing rate limiting on like password reset token validation by using essentially kind of distributed mechanisms to, say, use multiple source IPs to bypass IP-based controls, and then using racing, making a whole bunch of connections at once to bypass the, like, maximum number of guesses controls, you know, through parallelism, which is a pretty smart approach and a thing that, I mean, you know, I remember doing that 15 years ago on phone banking, where, you know, you could bypass those sorts of controls. And he had looked at some other vendors. I think Instagram, he had an account takeover on Instagram using this technique, went around, looked at a bunch of the other companies that have bounties, and eventually figured out that you could, in certain cases, use this to brute force the, like, PIN-based reset for Apple ID iCloud accounts. So you get a 6-digit number sent to you via SMS or whatever. If you can try, you know, the million possible combinations and you can bypass the rate limit, then you know, you'll get to the account takeover. And he reported this to Apple. Apple eventually came back and said, yes, you know, this is a thing. Yes, we're going to fix it. And they eventually offered him, I think, like $18,000 worth of bounty, when the kind of stated iCloud account takeover bounty is, you know, kind of maxes out at 100K or something like that.
The minimum, like 25K, is for limited unauthorized control of an iCloud account, going up to 100K for broad unauthorized control of an iCloud account. I mean, I guess you could argue it's not broad because doing this to, like, you know, 50,000 accounts all at once is going to get detected, but 18K seems a little stingy, I've got to be honest.
It did seem a little stingy. And I mean, I think one of Apple's arguments was that this only affected accounts where you didn't have like a macOS or an iOS device associated. So where getting a PIN via SMS was the only way of doing it. And normally if you have an Apple device, it'll pop up and say, hey, is this you on another device? And you have to enter a PIN.
Actually, that's a good point, and it could explain the stinginess. I didn't know that, but yeah, that could explain it.
So, I mean, you know, the number of people who have iCloud accounts but don't have an Apple device,
it's pretty low, you'd think. I mean, there'd be some leftovers, right, from like people with iTunes accounts and whatnot.
Is what the guy says. Yeah. He says, you know, like 50 million Android users have downloaded Apple Music. They've all got iCloud accounts now, but they don't have Apple devices, which...
Yeah, but you don't really get much by owning their iCloud device, iCloud accounts. So,
well, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so what? You get there, like, you know, you can listen to the MP3s that they've licensed, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, I can kind of see both sides of this, right? I mean, if you're a bug bounty hunter, I can imagine that you would be salty at not getting the big dollars. On the other hand, 18K is still, you know... Seems like reasonable money to me.
Yeah, it's not like they sent him a lump of coal, right?
No, exactly. I think he says that he didn't take the 18K and he just kind of dumped, you know, went full disclosure on Apple on his blog, which, you know, fair enough as well, I guess.
It's an expensive blog post.
It's an expensive blog post. I mean, like, you know. But yeah, just, you know, it's a little bit of bug bounty hunter sold. A little bit of Apple could be, I mean, you know, Apple does have a lot of money. It wouldn't cost them that much to spray a whole bunch of cash around fixing a bunch of dumb bugs, you know, versus what the snares of this world cost to, you know, keep in kombucha or whatever.
Yeah. Gotta love that sweet, sweet booch. Or as my 3-year-old calls it, boochy. Yes, we live in the Boochie. Northern Rivers, so this is where 3-year-olds know what kombucha is. Can't avoid it. Can't be avoided, unfortunately. But Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining us. And no show next week, so we're going to chat again in 2 weeks. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, lots of things that we react, and we'll have plenty of things to talk about. So see you then.
That was Adam Boileau there from CyberCX with a check of the week's security news. And big thanks too to CyberCX for its support of the Seriously Risky Business Weekly newsletter. That's all very helpful stuff. Oh, and a quick call out before we get moving. I'm trying to pull together any security people who might live in the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales. If you are an InfoSecker who lives in the Northern Rivers, do hit me up in my DMs. They're open on Twitter. I'm just Risky Business, one word. And so far, I've been able to find, let me just add it up, carry the two. I've found one person. One person who lives in Brunswick Heads. But yes, if you are an InfoSec person who lives in the Northern Rivers region, do hit me up. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Jake King, the CSO and co-founder of CMD Security. CMD began life as an agent that would mostly be used to do two things: restrict the commands users could execute on Linux systems and provide visibility into user actions on Linux fleets. It had all sorts of great features as well, like you could restrict certain commands and tasks such that the admin of a box would have to approve a user action via a duo push when someone wanted to do something. So just, you know, all around handy, good stuff. But of course, time marches on, customers log feature requests and drive development, and these days CMD does more. In addition to the control and visibility stuff, they're kind of like doing Linux IDR as well. So yeah, Jake joined me to talk about the types of Linux projects taking place out there that he's seeing among his customers, and the conversation just sort of kicks on from there. So here's what he had to say.
Yeah, we've caught a couple of projects that have been kind of midway through a container transformation. So they're going from a traditional host-based infrastructure to Kubernetes or container-based orchestrated systems. And they're doing so by lifting and shifting. So they take an instance running in an infrastructure, they pop it in a container and hope for the best. And that's really an interesting use case, because you'll find unusual practices being brought into the fold when you do this. People are running SSH in containers. They're running services in containers that they probably shouldn't be, persistent services. And they're kind of getting around a lot of the best practices of Kubernetes and some of the modern cloud services by kind of shoehorning technology in a way that probably shouldn't really fit. But where we've found...
So this is when you lift and shift and you don't change anything.
Yeah. And in a lot of respects, to a lot of these companies' credit, sometimes you can't change too much. You've got an uptime guarantee, a lot of complexity in the services, or you just don't have the team that actually built the service originally. And so you're kind of left holding the bag when it comes to infrastructure.
But as part of the automation part, you can start wedging in tools like CMD, right? And that gets you at least somewhere.
That's exactly right, Pat. And what we've found interesting is really just kind of gaining a bit of visibility into what these services are doing in the first place, looking at what processes are running on the systems, looking at the way that people interact with the services, pre and post kind of migrations being super interesting. But restricting services that you may have lifted and shifted is an interesting use case as well. And so kind of that's one
are
of the
you
use
do,
cases
we're
found. Are
you doing
really
service restriction now?
We've definitely started to edge towards it. And in process termination, a lot of the proactive controls that we've talked about in the past, you've started to see them come into our kind of IDR use cases, block the process, stop the process, and some of those capabilities. But where this gets really interesting, Pat, is when you've got something like SSH running in a container and you want to restrict entry points, right? You want to restrict SSH access to those containers to wean your team off those kind of legacy access methods. We've been able to instrument some of those use cases. And look, and what you're talking about now is talking about even, you know, maybe a more mature migration plan where organization understands the application well enough. They've rewritten it to operate in containers. They've leveraged Kubernetes to limit namespaces. They've really
But that's taken not how things work in the real world.
Yeah. But when they have, and we've seen this too, that's when that process observability, some of the IDR workflows that we've created, some of the IDR use cases that we've created actually start to become super useful. Looking at what's operating within the container, validating it's right, and seeing where it goes.
I mean, CMD is like one of those great examples, I think, like sort of like Signal Sciences, where you build a thing that has a use case that you've built it around, and then it goes into the market, and then all of a sudden your roadmap becomes completely determined by the customers, and it maybe takes you away from where you started a little bit. Like, I happen to know that you're not a massive fan of container-based architecture, for example.
Yeah, you're right, Pat. It's funny that you can kind of come full circle with a lot of this stuff. And look, I'm a fan of container architectures done right. I'm not a fan of when you apply, namespace level isolation when it should be kernel, kind of based isolation. There are a lot of things that we can do well, and sometimes we can jump on.
So it's more accurate early. To say maybe you're just not a fan of container based horror shows.
Yeah, pretty much. I think I've seen it go wrong one too many times to be a huge fan of a lot of it. That being said, I think where I've learned a lot is in architectures that are built right. When you've got a well-oiled machine that instruments the security controls in a way that makes sense, leveraging a container-based orchestrated architecture can be insanely positive from a security standpoint. You can limit access. You can do a whole bunch of stuff natively that you just haven't ever been able to do with legacy Linux systems. Legacy cloud Linux systems is included in that. But really, a lot of that kind of falls to the observability tools that you're leveraging. And it's really where we've found a lot of use cases with CMD that I've found really incredible. You mentioned it before. The market has really driven the way we've built our product. We started with SSH session observability. We built a really, I would say, a best-in-class way to look at user interaction with Linux systems. And now I've extended that into process-based observability and container observability.
I mean,
it's been interesting.
This is all stuff that you could do natively in Linux anyway, but no one ever did it, right? Because it was too hard. But it is kind of insane when you realize it's 2021 and sitting here going, yeah, we've got a tool that people are mostly using to get process observability in their production infrastructure. It's like, why was that not a thing until now? That's just crazy.
You hit the nail on the head, Pat. It's kind of funny when we think about it. There's been no unified way to try and pull this data, and
there are ways, but it's a project, not something you can just buy and shim in. It's a pain in the ass.
It's a process, right? Yeah. And it's a series of tools that we have to join together in a complex architecture of how we ingest it and process and alert on it. And that's not even before we've looked at preventative controls. And unfortunately, what that often means is we build these half-baked systems, we tie them to the Linux expert on the security team that's built it in the first place, and we just really cross our fingers and hope that they stay around for the duration of us actually getting the audit complete.
I mean, I know of many disasters when, say, two people running some particular control in a really complicated way leave. That happened recently at a place I know, and then that just resulted in chaos. But what was I going to ask? I was going to ask you, you mentioned earlier about sort of weaning people off SSHing into these containers and whatnot. How are you doing that? Are you just starting by restricting the types of commands that they can actually run via SSH, or are you locking out users, or you have to make some sort of policy change to spin up the service? Like, how are you actually going through that process of weaning them away from SSH?
So really it kind of comes down to entry point targeting. So we look at the entry points that are available to the system, and we've worked with clients that want to just show a notice in a terminal to say, hey, this is legacy access. We want to get you off this. We want to start moving towards this deployment methodology, or we want to start moving to this automation. Other organizations have just taken the full gamut approach, block the executions, prevent these users from doing anything. And we kind of spread the spectrum all the way in between. Everything from a multi-factor authentication controls that still remain pretty popular with, parts of
Yeah, because you've got a Duo integration, and even that has been pretty popular, right?
Yeah, thinking of ways that you can use that kind of challenge response nature to say, well, hang on a minute, do you actually need to do this? All the way to wrapping it in workflows, right? Let's create a Jira ticket every time someone accesses a system in a legacy manner. We're actually just going through our SOC 2 type 2. We've submitted all of our samples. We've got everything submitted and completed, and we showed our auditor our change management process for production. We have a ticket creation process around production access and stateful changes, and we're able to list everything in production. And that's just a real world example of how we've applied some of those controls to limit people's access, to minimize the way that we interact with systems and keep it compliant end to end. And it's certainly helped us even become better at the way we automate our systems at CMD. Everyone's needs break glass access. We all need to manage systems in some way, but not all the time. Everybody all the time.
I mean, I can imagine though that if people do that without really trying to educate their workforce, that's just going to result in a lot of tickets.
Yeah, you can you can definitely approach this in a graceful way. And a lot of the work that our team does alongside the way that we deploy with customers, especially in these more complicated situations where you're stretching to get a little bit more coverage, a little bit more understanding what the production infrastructure is doing, or a little bit more security from a control standpoint implemented. I think what often happens is that communication aspect can be really difficult, and we've got built-in workflows to make that easy for the teams we work with and mechanisms behind the scenes. I'm not going to use machine learning. It's statistical analysis.
There you go.
It's really just analyzing ways that patterns of usage in the environments. And that helps us target where we really want to focus with customers. If you've got an automation team that's just absolutely loaded up, they're using Ansible over SSH from their local machines to deploy production for that one service, there are ways that we can communicate that and build an effective control mechanism that allows you to either carve it out or, you know, create a secure as possible way of kind of performing those kind of actions. And that's important too, right? We can't all change overnight. And we can't expect that's going to be a good behavior to do so either.
The reason I mentioned Signal Sciences is because their whole thing is like WAFs suck, so we've created this other thing, and then they became, you know, basically next generation WAF. And you started off with like, hey, we've got this tool that allows you to allow list, you know, various commands on Linux per user, right? As a control, because you know EDR sucks on Linux, and now you're kind of EDR on Linux now.
Yeah, we're going to keep calling it IDR, Pat. You know, it's a different problem set to solve, but I will say you're exactly right.
Well, IDR is because it's servers, right, and workloads. Like, you know, you've changed one letter, but it's effectively like what you would get if you asked one of the EDR companies to really focus on Linux, which they don't. Yeah. You know, they say they do, but they don't.
You're exactly right. Yeah, and look at the way they invest the time on policies. Look to where they're investing the time on research and development in the technologies they implement. Look at the capabilities. You use the term allow listing. Allow and deny listing for an endpoint is very different to that of an infrastructure server. So it's so critical that we also don't overlap those two worlds in many ways. You don't want your IT team being able to control your production.
No, I mean, I get your point that it's not the same approach as like an EDR client for Windows. No, I get that. But it's what you wind up with in Linux world when you're trying to slice and dice the same problem.
When you solve the
right?
problem the right way. I often look back to that first Gartner kind of mention of EDR, and I think, you know, we're not mentioning infrastructure because we feel it falls into the same bucket. And I think that came from a point of naivety and maybe how much the infrastructure side of our world will absolutely, you know, has absolutely exploded over the last few years.
And the pandemic has just driven it into absolute overdrive, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And to that point, you know, you kind of hit one of the nails on the head of why so many of these initiatives are taking place now. We're now starting to think about ways to re-architect the platforms that we serve to our customers because our customers have changed. Platforms scale in different ways. Hell, you know, we have a IP reputation lookup service that we had to add a caching layer to because the amount of diverse IP addresses we were seeing. And it's an interesting mechanism to see how everything has changed and really rapidly so. And how our services can, you know, take advantage of that.
Well, Jake King, we all thank you for herding the Linux workload cats. It's a wonderful thing that you're doing. So thank you very much for joining us, and thanks a lot for sponsoring this week's edition of Risky Business.
Thanks again, Pat.
That was Jake King from CMD Security there. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to CMD for being a Risky Business sponsor. That is it for this week's show. There won't be a weekly show next week, but I am publishing a long-form interview with HD Moore. That's a Soapbox edition where we talk about HD's new thing, which is Rumble, and it's a really great chat, that one, so do check it out. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.